Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Ideas Matter podcast. We've got a new episode here today about communitarianism. My name is Alex.
My name's Louis.
And thank you for bearing with us through the break. I'm sure you've had time to digest our previous episode on liberalism. Now we're coming at you with a philosophical kind of outgrowth of liberalism that responds to some of its shortcomings. This is communitarianism. Now, today's episode is going to be mainly based around the writings of Daniel Bell, who is currently a lecturer at the uni that Louis is studying at. So Louis has quite a bit of familiarity with this. Louis, do you have anything to say about...
I mean, good idea to flag the self-interest. So I did read Daniel A. Bell, not to be confused with Daniel Bell, the famous cultural critic of capitalism. Different academic. This is Daniel A. Bell, who is a political theorist, political philosopher from Canada, who taught in Singapore for a while in the 90s, and now he teaches in China. And Alex is right. He is offering a subject at the uni that I'm studying at, and he's also my thesis advisor. So I'm insufficiently critical of his work, there's a reason for that. it's because I want good supervision on my thesis. But yeah, he's a really interesting thinker, and the reason I was first drawn to him was because he is explicitly criticizing Western liberalism using Confucianism these days. But that's not what he does in his first book. But you sort of understand in reading his first book how he came to his sort of later adoption of Confucianism. So I wanted to go right back to the beginning of his thinking, and that's communitarianism, which is something, Alex, that you were already interested in. Well, we were both interested in it, I suppose, but you had already read a major communitarian thinker before as well, Alasdair MacIntyre. So you already had some familiarity with like these kind of ideas, right?
Yeah, but it's the same kind of basic, like broad school of thought, but coming from a very different set of like influences. Alasdair MacIntyre kind of bases his philosophy around like Aristotle, whereas Daniel A. Bell is coming from a completely different perspective. So yeah, we're going to be focusing on Daniel A. Bell today, just because it'd take too long to kind of adequately cover everyone and where they're basing their arguments from. So this is going to be a kind of a broad overview of communitarianism from the kind of general perspective of how Daniel A. Bell conceives it, which I think is a pretty good perspective. Like, he does a really good job outlining its kind of basic tenets and concerns.
Yeah, as they might say in China, this could be called communitarianism with Daniel A. Bell characteristics. So we'll be focusing on that. But as the name implies, right, communitarian, communitarians put a lot more stock in the value of the community, broadly defined, and communal ties than do liberals. So I guess what makes a communitarian and something that Daniel Bell, Alasdair MacIntyre, Charles Taylor, Michael Sandel, how could I forget him? Something that they all have in common is that they're criticizing this sort of like abstract individual that we spoke about in our last episode, how liberalism defines the self, right? It assumes that like people are essentially individuals that don't have any innate qualities to them other than their like individual personhood. Communitarians are reacting to that. Specifically, they're reacting to John Rawls's book, A Theory of Justice, which was published either in the 70s, and then like communitarians really took off in the 80s, but they're reacting to that. So we're going to start with the liberal conception of the self, and that's probably best articulated by explaining briefly Rawls's theory of justice, how he gets there. So John Rawls, right, was trying to revive like liberal social contract theory in the 70s, when that there were two major competing ethical theories in political philosophy. There were utilitarianism and what's been described as intuitionism. And the problem with utilitarianism for a lot of people, including Rawls, is that it will give you very counterintuitive conclusions. So you could be justified in doing something horrific if it saved 100 more people than you're committing a crime against, for example. That seems to violate our ethical intuitions. So then you might try and construct a theory based on moral intuitions and say, well, that gives you a guide to how you should act morally. The problem with intuitionism is that it will sometimes give you competing intuitions, and your intuitions can't give you another intuition about how you should rank and prioritize your intuitions. So John Rawls in that context is trying to give you a theory that respects rights, so it doesn't do what utilitarianism does, but also gives you a systematic way of ranking your moral intuitions to give you a coherent liberal theory of justice. And to get there, he conceives of this thought experiment where he says, imagine you're behind a veil of ignorance. It's also sometimes called the original position, when you're in the original position behind the veil of ignorance. So the veil of ignorance is you stand outside society and you're constructing a society, but you don't know what role or place or status you're going to have in that society. You don't know whether you'll be a man or a woman. You don't know whether you'll be an ethnic majority, an ethnic minority, whether you'll be able to speak the language fluently, whether you'll be lower class, upper class, etc. So the idea is here, if you don't know what position you're going to hold in that society, you then have an interest in designing a society that will be of the greatest benefit to everyone and will protect the rights of those who might be less well off, because you could conceivably end up occupying that position, right? So Rawls sort of like tries to rationalize a liberal defense of rights through this original position. And this is where the communitarians come in and they say, okay, well, that's very well and good in theory, but it doesn't make any sense because there is no such thing as a person in the original position. It doesn't work as a theoretical device, because you can pretend. It's very similar to what we were talking about in our episode on Descartes, right? Mm-hmm. Like you can pretend that you're engaging in this process of radical doubt. But to do that radical doubt, you need to have an education that enables you to do that, right? You need to have first been brought up in a society that gave you the educational resources to engage in that project. So the communitarians are saying something similar about Rawls' original position. You can pretend that you're in an original position, but you can never really like rid your mind of all your biases or your prejudices or your unarticulated cultural assumptions that are going to go into this original position. So therefore, it's no surprise that a bunch of liberals pretending they're being purely rational would then just come back to the exact same conclusion. Yeah, we were right all along. We should have a liberal society. So that's where communitarianism first gets started. It's like criticizing this vague, abstract, liberal conception of the self.
Yeah. Yeah, like you're always going to, at least according to communitarians, people are always within some sort of context, some place, at some point in time, with some position in their society. And all of those things come together to create a set of ideas, a set of assumptions, a set of kind of what you might call like mental tools that are necessarily going to impact on the kind of conclusions they draw. So, yeah, you can't really go to a abstract position that's completely free of any and all influences, because the means by which you get to that position is going to be marked by the influences you have.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. And then I think there's an interesting concession in his first book, which is written as a dialogue form. It's really interesting, where his sort of like liberal critic goes, all right, sure, I'll concede that maybe like practically speaking, this original position is untenable, and that people are necessarily bound up in a social context. But while liberalism might fail descriptively in its conception of the self, Philip, this liberal critic, says, isn't it normatively still a good philosophy to have, because you're saying that it is morally desirable that individuals should be able to act as if they are individuals and choose their associations freely. Like if I'm born into a community and I don't like that community, and then I shouldn't just throw my hands up and say, oh, too bad, you know, communities are important to my identity. I have this ability to rationally decide, no, I want to go live somewhere else, or, you know, women, for example, there's a lot of like feminist critique at the end of the book written by another philosopher who says, okay, what about like patriarchy? Like you rationally decided that like this was an unjust system and people like actively tried to get out of their social conditioning. Like what does a communitarian have to say about that? So isn't liberalism still like normatively a good ideology? And I think his reply to that is very, very interesting, where he says that, first of all, it's just impossible, like psychologically, to ever extricate yourself from your upbringing because a lot of it is so like inarticulate and in the background. You could never like just say, oh, I'm no longer Australian. You would still see the world in a certain way as a result of your upbringing, and you just can't get rid of it, right? But then he says like people who do try to do that, I think the term he uses is they end up having a damaged personhood or a damaged selfhood. So it causes immense psychological damage when people try to escape their communities. And I thought that was an interesting point. What do you think about that? That this sort of like causes damage to people?
Yeah. I thought that was very interesting as well. Look, I'm not a psychoanalyst or anything, but I'm somewhat inclined to agree with it. People are, you know, constituted by their connections. Like you can't, and not just connections, but like constituted by things that they don't really have a choice in. Like you can't really choose not to love your parents. You can't choose not to be in love with someone. You know, you can't choose not to care about the community that you grew up in. You know, there might be things that get in the way of that, but that influence on who you are goes a long way in creating a kind of stable sense of self. You know, stability is found in large part through the things that you can't really choose. I think that the feminist critique is, you know, very important because, yeah, there are things that people don't freely choose, you know, to say be a woman in an oppressive patriarchal society. But I don't think that's something that can't be also treated through a communitarian critique. They could say, well, no, that it doesn't mean that you should blindly go along with whatever society's norms are. If anything, you ought to kind of fight against norms which are socially corrosive for all the members involved. You know, having an oppressive society to the point that it, you know, psychologically damages and, you know, physically impacts people as well, you know, say like domestic abuse, that is necessarily corrosive. So communitarians kind of have a duty to make sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah. And he draws a really interesting distinction at the end of the book, saying that there's a difference between liberal feminism and communitarian feminism. And it's not as if the communitarians can't be feminists, but a communitarian feminist would, rather than trying to like eschew all her quote unquote feminine qualities, right, to sort of try and shed them and say that they were like inherently negative and imposed upon her by a patriarchal society that was trying to like keep women down. I mean, there's obviously a lot of truth in that, like treating women as like, this idea that women are sort of inherently submissive or less intelligent than men, like that's obviously completely false. But you need not go too far in the other direction and say that there's no essential difference between men and women and that we should just like all become androgynous. Like a communitarian feminist would say, no, there are differences between men and women and these feminine qualities. He doesn't really do a good job defining them, but these sort of feminine qualities are inherently valuable. And it's sort of made me think of a point that I've always thought, like, rather than trying to like shunt women out of, let's say, childcare, a field which they dominate, and shunt them into, I don't know, banking, because banking is more highly paid and you're concerned with like the wealth gap, why not just reduce the salary of bankers and increase the salary of childcare workers? Like, why? This is sort of like liberal feminism is still in a sense like devaluing or diminishing feminine traits or feminine work, because it wouldn't recognize that distinction. It would say, no, like women are not doing this for any reason other than social conditioning. And they continue to say, yeah, they are. And there's nothing wrong with that. We just need to value it more highly. So I thought that was a very interesting reply.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. I generally agree with that. Like that, you find that liberal critiques of things or liberal positions are also tied up, not just tied up, but they sort of have like a blindness towards the influence of capitalism, which communitarians sometimes fall for this as well. You know, there is a difference between a communist and a communitarian. There's a real a strong distinction there. But, you know, you could readily reply that the wealth gap that exists between like a childcare worker and a banker is a dictate of the market. And as a result of that, you know, we should understand that markets are socially corrosive and that they kind of, they necessarily chip away at these sort of communal understandings of who people are and how they should relate to one another. But that's kind of getting ahead of ourselves. We're going to get back to that, the kind of concern a bit later.
But just on that briefly, I mean, that is kind of how I first came to communitarianism, right? This, it's sort of more, it's economic critique, which it spends much less time on, but it's still interesting because it sort of criticizes free market capitalism as being premising individualism and there as a result undermining communal ties, like forcing people to work like, I don't know, 60, 65 hour weeks, multiple jobs, having to travel for work and therefore not having a connection to where they were brought up, not having any time to spend with their kids or any free time to like form communities. Communitarianism really, you know, takes it to free market capitalism for having those socially corrosive effects. So that's how I first came into it. So I think it's good to bring that up. But back to the idea of the self, I mean, it sort of follows, right, from what Rawls is talking about and what liberals are talking about, that it's morally desirable that you should be able to choose, like rational choice made by an individual, an uncoerced individual, is kind of like the highest good for liberalism. If we can get you in that position, then we've done our job. We're not going to tell you how to live your life after that because you're rational. You're going to choose how to live your own good life. Good luck to you. Just don't harm anyone else, right? That all rests upon this idea that like choice is morally desirable. And Bell has this really interesting part of the book where he actually pushes back on that. And it's so counterintuitive just because you would never think of it. But he gives this brief little story. He says, imagine two people, right? You've got one woman who really imbibes like liberal individualism. And she goes, right, okay, I'm going to rationally plan the rest of my life. Obviously, this is a bit of an exaggeration, but you get where he's going with it. I'm going to rationally choose my degree, that which will give me the highest paying job. I'm going to, you know, work my way up. I'm going to career climb, go up the social ladder at work to get the highest paying job. I'm deliberately going to hold off getting a partner or falling in love until I've hit a certain benchmark in my career. And even then, I'm going to choose a partner who I've rationally decided is like most compatible with my interests and my life goals and has good genetics and will have a good kid together. So it's sort of like an exaggeration of like this liberal, rational choice. Like choice is great.
No, it just sounds like an average person in Melbourne Uni Business School, to be honest.
Yeah, well, it may be, right. It's maybe probably not that much of an exaggeration, right? Like I've actually
heard that a lot. I've heard a lot of those things.
Actually, as I'm saying that, it did remind me of someone I went to high school with who once said that, like, I think this was in year 12, they said, I'm not going to give any indication of who they were. They said that for year 12 that they were only doing things that would benefit their career. They weren't going to do anything else. They weren't going to play sport for fun. They weren't going to hang out with friends. It was everything was going to be viewed through the prism of like, does this help or hinder my career path? Yeah. So maybe it's not that much of an exaggeration. These people do exist, right? And then he compares this with this other person who doesn't really know what he wants to do with his life. Just randomly like enrolls in a photography degree at uni because it looks kind of interesting. Turns out he really enjoys it and he's kind of good at it. So he starts taking photos and he gets a part-time job doing that. And then his dad owns a business and his dad's like, well, why don't you come and work for me for a little while? And he starts doing that. Again, none of this is chosen, but he's sort of finding that he really enjoys everything that he's doing. And then he starts to like volunteer on the weekends. Then he meets a woman and he falls in love with her, but he like never thought that he would fall in love with that type of woman, right? And then they have kids. And he ends this discussion by saying, who do you think is happier? The person who rationally chose every part of their life and deliberately suppressed the more emotional parts? Or this person who, like all the significant events in their life, they didn't rationally choose them, but nonetheless, they seem pretty happy. Like, who do you think is the happier person in this scenario?
Yeah, it seems pretty straightforward. I don't think we need a layout to.
Yeah.
If you think it's one of those who we're not implying it is, then I want you to email us so we can refer you to a psychologist.
Yeah. So just on this idea of like psychological damage, he does lean pretty heavily on this. And I honestly wonder if it's because his first degree was in psychology. He told me he enrolled in a psychology degree and then he attended a political theory class as an elective, I think. And he was like, wow, this is way more interesting. But there is a lot of psychology in the dialogue and in his work talking about the psychological damages that liberalism has on people. And it makes a lot of sense. I mean, we were kind of sort of talking shit before the podcast started about this idea of rootlessness and people who travel around all the time and don't really belong anywhere. And I feel like it is, I think you made a really good point when you said it was this kind of aspect of upper middle class culture in the West, where because we have the capacity to go overseas every year and study overseas and work overseas for a few years and do your degree at all like different unis, undergrad at one uni, master's at another uni, PhD at another uni, ideally all overseas, right? Or you've got to leave high school and go overseas or go interstate. That kind of worldview has always really struck me as like profoundly unfulfilling because you don't really belong anywhere. So I suppose intuitively intuitively always a communitarian, because that sort of lifestyle has never really appealed to me. And it's kind of like denigrated, I feel, in our culture, like people who live in the one city their whole life, this sort of like this sort of elitist looking down on that, like you're so parochial, you're kind of like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. It's seen as like, oh, you're not really living a life if you're just staying in the one place the whole time. And look, don't get me wrong, like I enjoy traveling. I actually have studied overseas.
I will be too, right?
So yeah, but more in the sense of like people who are constantly moving around and completely like uprooting their whole lives, not like you go spend like a year overseas or something and then you go back home. Like there's this kind of idea, especially like as a status symbol, like you said, among like upper middle class, upper class people, that you're not living your best life unless you spend major parts of it living in places away from where you grew up. And it really does lead to a sense of unfulfillment, you know. Even just anecdotally, when I was studying in Hong Kong, which is where I study overseas, I had a friend there who was raised in one country until they were like 10, moved to another country, then moved to the other side of that country, and then moved to another country on a different continent. And it just constantly moving around with no roots anywhere. And they were telling me like, I feel unfulfilled. I don't know what to do with my life because I don't have any connections anywhere. And I'll be honest, I do. At the time, I didn't really know what to say. Like now I would say, well, you got to put some roots somewhere. Otherwise, you're going to keep feeling like this. But yeah, it definitely does take a toll on people.
Yeah, absolutely. It does. And he gives an example very similar to that in the book where he said, like, yeah, people who moved around a lot as kids and don't have a sense of belonging or community anywhere, he says, it's actually like profoundly psychologically damages people, and they're incapable of forming deep attachments with people, and they will actually run away from them. They'll keep up this pattern of moving even though it's like causing them unhappiness, because they're actually unable to form deep attachments. Look, I'm not a psychoanalyst. I'm not a psychologist, so I'm not going to like weigh into that too heavily. But it seemed very like commonsensical and intuitive to me.
Because well, I'll just be outright with it for the listeners. I absolutely love armchair psychoanalysis. I love sitting back and feeling like Freud.
I love it too, but I try not to do it in public. all 10 of our listeners, you know, hit me up privately if you want to do some armchair psychoanalysis. But look, yeah, this idea, like all kidding aside, like this idea of people staying in the one place and feeling connected to their community and sort of liberals looking down on that as being like parochial or backward looking or some kind of like, I don't know, country bumpkin, right? It this has very...
Sorry, this just occurred to me now, but like you can see this in the kind of political tensions between settler colonial states, like Western ones, and Indigenous people. Like looking at Indigenous lands rights struggle here, where a liberal perspective, you know, and also genocidal colonial one, if you look at the history of colonization in Australia, is no one is fundamentally tied to their land. You are a free agent and you can own land and you can buy it and you can have a connection to it that way. But you are a free agent who is capable of defining themselves however they want through free will, through rational choice. And you don't have any sort of intrinsic connection to the place that you're from. Whereas a massive part of kind of Indigenous understandings of the self is like, no, I am fundamentally tied to this land. This land is part of me. I'm part of this land and there's no separating the two.
Yeah, I never drew that connection, but that does make a lot of sense. I thought about it more in the like modern political tensions in Western societies between, I suppose, like the inner city urban elite and more sort of like rural or suburban communities who do feel a sense of attachment to their local community, their local identity, their local sports team. And these sort of like Ivy League or in Australia, like, you know, Uni Melb, Uni Sid, like constantly changing cities, blah, blah, blah. Like they kind of look down on that because they themselves don't have a sense of attachment. And yeah, I think it's a very like real tension, more so in American politics, but in British politics as well. There was this really interesting book called The Road to Nowhere or The Road to Somewhere by David Goodhart. And he was talking about this new political divide in the West, but he uses Brexit as an example. And a lot of people who voted for Brexit, you know, feel like a sense of attachment and belonging and identification with their like heritage and their tradition. And people who voted against Brexit feel this more sort of like international attachment. They don't really see themselves as being English. They see themselves as being European or like a citizen of the world, right? And that's fine. That's all very well and good. But then they kind of like smear the people who identify with their like traditional heritage as being like backwards and racist and unnecessarily conservative. So I think it is a real political tension. And it's one that I've never understood because even though I like consider myself like very left wing, I've never understood the progressive tendency to view patriotism as being a bad thing. I don't think it's a bad thing. I mean, I think you probably agree with me on that, right?
Yeah. It definitely seems to be a uniquely Western sort of phenomenon. I don't think you can go to any other part of the world where there's a massive set of people who think that it's uncouth or distasteful to have a real affection for and concern with your culture's traditions. You know, I know for a fact my family's from a Slavic country, you know, Central Eastern Europe, where people kind of make fun of those kind of Westerners, thinking like, well, you have no respect for your own culture. Like, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah, it's kind of bizarre. And there is a contradiction within it as well, because like those same sort of progressives in the West, right, who claim to not be patriotic and have no special attachment to their own country, at the same time will feel like guilty and ashamed of bad things their country has done in the past, which like I obviously agree with. Like in the case of Australia, we have the stolen generations, the violence that like Australia was founded on. Like I feel a sense of shame over those things. And I think it's incumbent upon me as a modern Australian to try and like rectify them. But it seems contradictory that you would like identify with the bad things, but not identify with the good things. Like that you, it seems to me you just can't have one without the other. You either identify with your past or your ancestors' past, or you don't. You can't be like a total chauvinist and only look at your country's good things. And you can't be a total like white guilt person and only look at the bad things. Like a coherent position is to acknowledge like how contextual you are and how you've benefited from the good and the bad, and do your best within a community to, you know, diminish the bad and raise up the good.
We find meaning through the contradictions.
Yeah, we do. But this brings us to the next part. So if you accept the communitarian critique, right, that like the sense of self is not, as liberals say, it's not abstract, it's not decontextualized. Therefore, you can't really engage in moral and political reasoning from this like a priori abstract position. You have to be situated. You have to be socially embedded.
I think this is something that like is broadly agreed upon by any sort of communitarian thinker. Yep. Like particularly this part about like the importance of your context for like moral reasoning.
Yeah, for sure. So you were saying before we started, right, that like Alistair McIntyre, when it comes to this, he draws much more heavily on Aristotle, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
So Aristotle said what, like humans are social beings, animals?
Humans are political animals, so they're necessarily social. Per Aristotle, there's no understanding of what it means to be a human separated from our social ties. We are human because of our social ties. So it really butts heads against the liberal conception of, no, you are this free agent that exists prior to any connections, you know, this Aristotle, and through Aristotle, Thomas Aquinas, and through Thomas Aquinas, Alistair McIntyre view is, no, you are your connections.
Yeah, absolutely. And then within that, like you have a role in your communal society and you should strive to like fulfill that role. Isn't he a virtue ethicist in that sense?
Yeah, he is a virtue ethicist. Virtue ethics is a school of ethics that posits good ethical judgment or behavior arises from the cultivation of good character, both in individuals and throughout society. And through molding yourself and through following positive examples, through embodying virtues in your actions, then you have a better means of resolving moral tensions and moral issues. And to have any sort of virtue ethics understanding of morality, it has to take place within a community. You know, there have to be these connections with other people in a society that define what virtuous action is. Otherwise, you're just kind of making shit up as you go along and it's not going to lead to anything.
Right. Okay. So that's a really good place to start, because the liberal critic in this Bell dialogue that he wrote says, okay, sure, but what happens if you're situated in a community that is doing things that are morally horrific? Like, what if you just happen to be born in Nazi Germany? Are you really going to fulfill your roles within that society? Like, don't you still need some place to stand, like rationally, to like rationally criticize moral values? You can't just totally outsource this to like the community. And Bell's reply, I think, is fairly persuasive. He says that you need to do moral reasoning based on shared understandings, right? So every society has things that it purports to value. So in America, you know, it's like freedom, individual liberty, that sort of stuff. In Australia, yeah, it's that, but not as much. I think probably like a fair go. This sort of sense of egalitarianism is probably much stronger. So Bell would say, okay, if something in a community is going wrong and you want to criticize it, you need to criticize it with reference to those shared values. Otherwise, other people in your society just won't register with them. It won't make any sense, right? So like the institution of slavery in America, you could have made a case that like it actually went against American values of individual liberty. So it was able to be abolished within that sort of framework, right? You need to appeal to things that people already believe. And Bell says you can make that moral progress by encouraging like better understandings of these like implicit shared values.
Yeah, no, I think that's completely intuitive. Like you wouldn't go to someone who opposes like civil rights in America in the 60s, and you wouldn't be like, say, like a Hindu from India going to someone who opposes civil rights and saying, no, you're not fulfilling your duty to uphold Dharma.
Like, yeah.
It's completely nonsensical because you're not appealing to them on terms that they understand.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good example. You'd ask them, like, do you believe that all men and women are created equal?
Mm.
Yes. Like, okay, then if you believe that, then how can you accept X, Y, and Z? You know, it's like reasoning from a shared positioning, which we all have.
Like if they happen to be a Christian, you would say, well, aren't all people created before God? Why would God create inherent inequalities between people? You know, all souls are equal before God, so therefore all souls are equal on earth. Like, yeah, exactly right. You use the tool sets that is also held by people within that particular context.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I just found it like quite interesting at the last Australian federal election that like both major parties, like in their like radio adverts, drew on the idea of like the fair go. This idea in Australia, like you have a fair go. It kind of sounds meaningless. It kind of is, but I guess it goes back to like when we were settled. And it was a very strong workers' movement. So as a result, like egalitarianism has a stronger purchase on the Australian psyche than it does, say, in America, right? Although that's a pretty low bar to say that there's more egalitarianism than there is in America. Like, I think that's true of everywhere, right? But yeah, like, I just found that quite interesting that like two sides of like the political parties were still appealing to the same value, because that makes sense to people. They can intuitively grasp, but they go, oh yeah, I believe everyone has a fair go. Which party is going to be better at like delivering that, right?
Yeah, and then this leads nicely into how liberals conceive of morality, in that no, there are universal moral truths that apply everywhere. So say the liberal understanding of human rights, and how this contrasts with say, not so much of a debate anymore, but like that old debate in political theory about Asian values, which is kind of like a particular understanding of rights, like rights in a certain context. So say a liberal would have an understanding that no, everybody has the right to completely free association. They should not be manipulated or kind of coerced into associating with anyone if they don't freely choose to do so. And they take this to be something that applies universally. Where Daniel Bell brings this up, which I thought was a very good point, in East Asia, for instance, there are completely different understandings of what constitutes like an unassailable right or an unassailable duty in the West. Like in the West, the average person wouldn't really give any doubt to the idea that, you know, people should be able to choose who they associate with and in what capacity. Whereas in East Asia, countries will debate on the best way to fulfill the duty to care for one's elderly parents. You know, there's this, particularly in countries with the Confucian tradition, there's this real strong sense of filial piety. You know, you are obligated to respect and care for your parents, especially when they become old enough that they're not capable of looking after themselves, on their own. And East Asian countries each different country will have debates over what is the best way to kind of assure this duty. You know, do you have a legal requirement on children that they have to take care of their parents past a certain age? Or do you apply tax breaks to make it more affordable for people who do have their parents living with them? But nobody debates the idea that this duty is important. it's just seen as a completely natural moral claim to make in these societies that, no, you do have a duty to care for your elderly parents. The matter is, how do we go about kind of protecting or instituting that duty? So this liberal understanding of like universal rights really does butt up against other contexts where there are different understandings of what is a natural moral right or a natural moral claim.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that example up, because I remember the first time that I read that, that in certain Asian societies, it's sort of an expectation, and like the state will actively encourage people to look after their elderly parents and provide healthcare to their elderly parents. So I remember bringing that up in a class I was doing at uni. It was a class on China. And I made this point, and one of the people taking it, I think he was a sociologist, and he said, yeah, well, as a sociologist, I would say that that's because those countries don't have sufficiently developed healthcare systems. So them outsourcing this to families is just a way to make up for the fact that their like state isn't sufficiently developed. And I thought, what a perfect example of like question begging. Like, you're assuming your own position. You've assumed that a more developed state equals a state that treats people as individuals, right? You've just assumed that, like, if people are asked to care for their family, then that equals an insufficiently developed state. Like, it just was just so profoundly narrow-minded, and like his reply was just so revealing, I thought.
Yeah, liberals are really good at the question begging.
Yeah, they really are. They really, really are.
And yeah, I thought that was a very good point. We've just looked at the kind of the understanding of the self, and we've looked at the kind of understanding of morality and moral life. Communitarianism has a third strand, which is kind of political concerns. How does liberalism impact on political and social realities, and what does communitarianism have to say about this as well?
Yeah, this is quite an interesting part of the book. So it begins, as all communitarianism does, by criticizing liberal politics and its effects. So as I mentioned earlier, like I was quite taken by like their critique of liberal economics, right? That it's sort of this excessive emphasis on free markets like erodes what people care about in life. It erodes communities. It erodes people's free time. I remember this being like very like well articulated when I was sort of paying attention to the American election in 2020, when you had all these Democrats running for the president. And I'm sure you've all heard of Andrew Yang before. And I found him like to be a pretty interesting guy. And I was listening to him talk, and someone asked him a question about Rust Belt communities, these sort of like dilapidated communities that used to be manufacturing towns that now, don't have many jobs and they're in the grips of an opioid crisis. And his solution to this problem was, he said, oh, look, it's not that the American economy can't produce jobs. It's that they're producing jobs in California and New York, right? They're not producing them in these places. So it's not that there's not enough jobs. It's that the people aren't in the right places. So his solution was to give people tax credits to move. And that just struck me as being like so wrong-headed. I was like, what if they want to live there? Like, life isn't about just chasing a job. What if you want to live in the same community that you were born in, that your parents were born in, that your grandparents, like, what if you have an attachment to this community and you don't want to leave it and you would like to see it revitalized? You're going to just like take people out, like give them money to make them move. What about the people? And then what about the people who are left behind? They're even worse off now because you've left. So I just thought that was such an indicative example of how liberal economics and this idea of individualism has really corrosive effects on people.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's a great example, because it just, it kind of impinges upon people's rights as well. Like, you're just saying to people that, well, if you want to actually have a life that you can enjoy materially, you have to completely uproot and go somewhere else. You can't have that life where you are right now, which is a pretty, even on liberalism's own terms, it seems like a moral failure to me.
Oh yeah, I totally agree. And he has, Daniel Bell talks briefly about how you should, rather than having, so this problem specifically is like a result of what he says, like consumer oriented economies. So everything is couched in terms of like, will it make prices cheaper for the consumer? He says we need to have producer oriented economies. Like, does this give people in jobs an ability to like keep producing things and having well paying jobs? So we should reorder and restructure our economies to be more producer oriented rather than consumer oriented, which I found to be a good point.
It seems to me so much of communitarianism flirts with socialism, but it doesn't go all the way.
Yeah, it doesn't, at least not explicitly. I wonder what you think. Do you think that all socialists and all Marxists would be communitarians in some sense, but not all communitarians are socialists and Marxists?
Yeah, I'd broadly agree with that, because I don't, at least if you are going by Marxism, Marx's idea of like the ideal kind of post-capitalist society is people living in their own communities, you know, communes, hence communism, where everybody kind of cooperates to ensure the kind of the material comfort and the personal leisure of everybody else in that community. So I do think, you know, if you are following Marxist terms, you do end up being kind of necessarily communitarian. But yeah, I don't think that communitarianism itself requires a buy-in to socialism.
That's true.
I think, just because of my own political perspective, I think it makes a lot more sense if you do a buy-in to socialism, but I don't think it's, as far as like theoretical concerns, I don't think it's necessary.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessary either. I think they're probably like overlapping. I mean, look, our next episode will be on Marxism, I think, right? Yeah. So we can get into this more. But, you know, there's also... Juicy. Pardon?
That's going to be a juicy one.
Oh, yeah. That's going to be a two-hour episode. but I think there's also a sense in which, like, Marxism, I'm probably going to get hate for saying this, but, like, Marxism itself is also an outgrowth of liberalism because...
Yeah, for sure.
I think, like, I've started thinking this recently. Wouldn't like the communist utopia, let's just put aside whether you think that's practically feasible or not. The communist utopia is almost indistinguishable from a liberal utopia, because like liberals want a really small state that doesn't really do anything. A communist utopia, they want the state to wither away. I think Marx has this quote about like a society of like freely associating producers.
Mm-hmm.
So people just, it's liberal in the sense that like society and the state is not going to tell people, individuals, how to live their life. It doesn't posit any like good life. It's sort of like liberalism in the same sense that it like tells you what's bad. Alienation is bad. Commodification is bad. But it doesn't tell you what's good. It sort of leaves that up to you. It wants to create like the material conditions where everyone can spend their free time doing whatever they please, and the means are the ends in themselves. You don't paint or read to get a job or to make money. You just do it because you intrinsically enjoy it. And I think that's an incredibly compelling moral vision, but I think it still suffers from the same flaws that liberalism does, because without some like positing of like a shared end goal or like a higher good, a lot of people are going to find that kind of society deeply unfulfilling. And it's economics aside, it is the aspect of communitarianism that I find more persuasive than Marxism, because I think that people do need, I think Zizek calls it this, the big other, right? People need something to orient their life towards. You can't just say, oh, you know, individuals spend your free time however you want. You need some kind of like unjustified or self-justified end goal that is shared, communally shared, that you need to work towards as a society.
Yeah, no, I think you're spot on with that. As to like the relationship between liberalism and Marxism, there is a book by Friedrich Engels, famous collaborator of Marx, called What is Socialism, where he kind of tracks the intellectual history of socialism and Marxism, And one of the major influences, you know, even according to Engels, who is one of the big daddies of it all, is like radical French liberals like Rousseau, who put forward this idea of the individual who's able to kind of freely associate and do so against the tyranny of the state.
Yeah, well, we should... Have you read that? What is Socialism by Engels?
Yeah, yeah.
I want to read that in preparation for our episode on Marxism. It sounds very interesting.
Yeah, let's do it. But anyways, we'll talk about that more in the Marxism episode. That's the socialism. I do think you can... This is kind of where you get the separation between Marxism and socialism. You know, like all Marxists are socialists, but not all socialists are necessarily Marxists.
Yeah.
So I do think you can have like a communitarian socialism, but I haven't done any of the kind of like thinking behind that, but it doesn't seem like a contradiction in terms to me.
No, it doesn't. But there are things that Bell proposes in the book that I think socialists wouldn't agree with. I mean, he says that we should have compulsory national service, right? I think that would be pretty divisive amongst socialists. Although I personally agree with it. I think there should be a form of like national service to basically encourage citizens to develop like communal ties with one another and to instill this idea that like the point of life is not individual career fulfillment, but it's serving the good of the community, right? Mm-hmm. And sort of like making that mandatory for 1 to 2 years after you leave high school, I think would be a good. I actually support that, provided that you can do civilian service. You don't have to go do military national service.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with that proposal. He also says things that I'm slightly less inclined to agree with, like it should be harder to get divorced, for example. Not sure that I really agree with that. But then he says other things that I think all progressives would agree with, that like minority languages should be protected and celebrated and like actively revived. I mean, this is obviously like his Canadian influence coming in, right? That like, you should preserve like French speaking parts of Canada. I mean, as someone with Scottish heritage, like I was really pleased to hear that like the Scottish government is like actively reviving Gaelic, and like now in Scotland on road signs, it has the English and the Gaelic. I think that's fantastic. And so there's like those proposals as well that I think a lot of people would agree with. So like parts of it can sound conservative and parts of it can sound progressive. So I think it's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. That's something that struck me when I first started reading about communitarianism, is how much of a mix it is between those two strains and how you can't really fit it into one or the other. You know, there are parts of it that completely criticize left-wing things, and there are parts of it that completely criticize right-wing things. For example, there's, I have this quote in another book I've been reading, by Camille Paglia. It's kind of like a book on art, but it does have this very relevant critique of liberalism and kind of left-wing liberals in the intro that I think is completely relevant. I'll just read this out. Modern liberalism suffers unresolved contradictions. It exalts individualism and freedom and, on its radical wing, condemns social orders as oppressive. On the other hand, it expects government to provide materially for all, a feat manageable only by an expansion of authority and a swollen bureaucracy. In other words, liberalism defines government as tyrant father, but demands it behave as nurturant mother. Look, this is kind of like a bit of a psychoanalytic book, so you see that those terms coming in the end there. But I think it really encapsulates a communitarian critique of like the modern left wing, which is left wing people, liberals generally advocate for people's freedoms and people's freedom from the state and all of that. But to fulfill those material concerns, you need to have this bigger bureaucracy, which does necessarily expand the state's power. So there's kind of a contradiction in terms in left liberalism with its relationship to the state.
Yeah, I think this is probably like the single most biggest contradiction in liberalism, is that like on the one hand, it wants a small state It doesn't want a tyrant state. But at the same time, by saying, by outsourcing things to the individual or to people, it at the same time erodes their very capacities to do the things that they don't want the state to do. Mm. I mean, this kind of is like, you hear this said by conservatives quite a lot, but I think that they have, there's a lot to be said for this argument that, like, if you erode communities, if you erode families, right, then the state has to step in more and more to make up for that. And so it's a bit of a contradiction if you say that you want a small state, but then you create the conditions where the state has to intervene more and more and more. This just reminded me of an interesting, like, empirical case study that Bell cites in the book, where there was this, like, local town, and I think it lost maybe like a big employer there. So, like, unemployment went up and then crime went up, right? And then in this study, what they did was they encouraged people to, like, clean up their local town, like to renovate, like, the main shopping strip, to pick up rubbish. They basically encouraged people, like, they encouraged businesses to come and, like, employ people, and crime went down by just making people feel more attached to their surroundings, which I found really, really interesting. 'Cause he also talks about local communities should have a veto power over new developments, for example, that don't fit with their pre-existing architectural style in that town, which I loved. But again, it is also like a bit of a weakness in that, like, communitarianism will identify the flaws, like the symptoms. Like, you know, you and I are from the same suburb, and I'm sure you remember as well as I when there were, like, those proposed developments in that part of our town, and there were all these, like, signs saying save Williamstown, that people didn't want these high rises because it would be, like, an affront to this, like, historical area. And whilst I sort of agree with that, it seems to me that, like, that kind of worldview really lacks any analysis of, like, why that happens in the first place. Like, why do you have rapid development and, like, rapid population growth in these sort of areas? It's because we have an economic system that is premised on rapid growth. So you can attack the symptom, but if you don't have an analysis of, like, why that happened, then your worldview is a little bit, feels unsubstantiated.
All roads lead to Marx.
Yeah. We're really setting up this next episode, like, quite well.
I thought you had a really great point on the kind of psychological impacts of, like, connecting to your community, like, through cleaning up your town. If anybody's read the, it's a pop psychology book, but it's a good one, Lost Connections by Johan Hari, where he's this journalist and he's discussing the causes, like, why is depression and anxiety so prevalent in modern Western societies? And he nails a lot of it down to, you know, just basic lack of connection between people within society, you know, within communities. Connections have been eroding steadily over the past couple of decades. And a result of that is a concurrent rise in mental illness, particularly depression and anxiety. And he makes a very compelling case for it. And he draws on similar things, like anything that lets people, like psychological studies where they track people with mental illness doing something that contributes to their community, like they do community gardening projects or something like that, ends up actually relieving mental illness in those people. So there is a very strong case to be made for, you know, the relationship between community and mental health, which I think communitarianism does a really good job of providing a theoretical basis for as well.
Yeah, I think that's where it's definitely on its strongest grounds when it's talking about sort of the psychological damage that excessive individualism does. So just to recap, I think in 3 points, if you wanted to say what is communitarianism, communitarians argue that the self is socially embedded. We're contextual creatures, we're social animals, to paraphrase Aristotle. So that would be the first point that all communitarians share. The second point, which I'm not sure is as universal, but a lot of them do agree on, is that, like, moral and political reasoning therefore needs to be done in reference to that community. So in the case of Alistair McIntyre, it's like, what role do you hold in that community? So it's a more virtue ethic argument, whereas Daniel Bell is saying it's about shared understandings and reasoning from shared understandings, and he grounds this in a lot of philosophy of language as well. And then the third point is that if community is valuable and if humans are social beings, then our political concerns should give weight to those communities. And to what we were saying before, you know, this can be interpreted in progressive and conservative ways. So he has a really good defense in the book of like gay rights, for example. But it could also sound like somewhat conservative if you're using it to like defend patriotism, right? So I think it's a good example of how communitarianism sort of resists this kind of left-right categorization.
Yeah, no, I think that's spot on. You've really nailed the three broad tenets. Right, look, that about wraps it up for this episode. A lot of the things we started talking about, especially toward the end, very neatly slide into our next episode, which is going to be What is Marxism?
Mm.
Now, we're going to have a lot to say about that one. So, that one's going to take some reading. And it's also, I don't know, should we do it as one long episode or should we break it up into two episodes?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, look, there's Marxism,
yeah.
There's socialism, and there's communism.
Yeah.
And if you ever wondered, well, what is the difference, then that's the episode for you, my friends. But yeah, we could do... I don't know. That's a really good question. We could do one on like Marxism as a philosophy, and then we could do one on like socialism as like an economic paradigm.
Yeah, I reckon that's good.
We should do that.
Yeah.
So like, what is Marxism, and then like, what is socialism?
Yeah.
All right. Cool. So the first one will be, I don't know, I imagine like dialectical materialism, blah 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 blah, and then the next one will be like capitalism, alienation, etc.
Yeah. All right. You heard it, folks. Those are the next two episodes. Thank you very much.
I feel like we've all been heading. This is where we're going to peak.
It's all downhill from the next one.
Well, it's either all downhill or from that point on, like ideas matter just becomes like a very like outwardly, unashamedly like Marxist podcast.
Dude, you're going to be going to China. You should get some CCP funding for us.
Yeah, let's cut that bit out. All right. All right. See you later.